Welcome to the Business Addicts Podcast. Today I have Wendy here, and as far as I know, she is a specialist in narcissism. But as always, I would love for you to introduce yourself and tell us more about what you do and maybe a little bit of how you got into it.
Thanks, Tammy. Thanks for inviting me to be with you. It's a pleasure. I'm the author of Disarming the Narcissist, which is now in its third edition. And I'm an expert in all things narcissism. So working with individuals who have narcissistic personalities, working with partners and family members who have been impacted by narcissists in their lives, either broken up or in their romantic relationships. I also am a trainer in schema therapy, which is the model, the approach that I use for treating complex personality types like narcissism. So I spend part of my time teaching and some of my time in consultation and some of my time actually doing therapy.
So as always, I'd like to jump right in and kind of go as vulnerable or as real as you'd like to take us, because this is actually a topic that, you know, I think I shared with you. My mom told me before she died of cancer, she said, "Your dad's a narcissist. I just want you to know that." And I went to Google. I didn't know about people like you and even really what to do. And Google didn't have any answers for me. And so I feel like it's such a, it's one of those buzzwords that's thrown out there, but yet we don't really know what does that actually mean. And so what are some of the things that you would love for people to know about how, yeah, anything in your field? We just need to get started.
I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, as I like to say, there's a lot of mythology on the internet. So, you know, buyer beware. It's, there's a tendency towards weaponizing and demonizing narcissists. The confusion comes with sort of seeing them all as if they're psychopathic. And that's unfortunately what you see. Run for your life. This is Satan. This is the devil. They can't change. It's very difficult to get narcissists to change. It's tough, right? I mean, it requires a lot, and I can get into that more if you like, but it's not impossible. They are wounded people. They do some really hurtful things. There is no doubt about it. They can leave someone upended, you know, with no sense of where reality lies. But they're not, I mean, they may be psychopathic, but typically narcissism means someone who is highly self-absorbed, feels a great sense of entitlement to do as they please, make the rules, break the rules, feel that they are unique and special and shouldn't have to follow the same order as everyone else. They can be very controlling, manipulative. They can be very charming too, and very heroic in their actions. But these are people who have enormous sensitivity to criticism, a deep feeling of inadequacy at the core. Usually have been lacking from the time they were little in this thing called unconditional love, with a lot of emphasis placed on performance and achievement and extraordinariness, which is why many of them are great leaders, but not necessarily great partners or great parents.
Okay, so as you're talking, part of me is checking and doing a self-check, like, is this Kevin and I? Are we both narcissists? Like, what? Where's the line between, you know, feeling, because I do like to color outside of the lines and break the rules. So I might be in that category. This might be a little too close to home.
Well, you have to ask yourself other questions. I mean, I left out a few things that I think are probably relevant when we're doing a self-assessment, right? We can all do this sometimes. It can be annoying sometimes. We can be a little bossy sometimes. We can be a little self-focused sometimes. The question really is, do you have the capacity to be reciprocal, to give and take, to kind of step into the shoes of another, to have empathy, to take responsibility if you've done something that's hurtful? It may not always be easy, but to look at it and appreciate the impact on another. These are things that narcissists have a lot of trouble with because of that insufficiency underneath, that sense of shame, that fear of being seen as the bad guy, and that really strong self-righteous entitlement that kind of colors everything and justifies their actions. I don't know if that helps, but maybe that helps.
Absolutely, that helps. Kevin, what's coming up for you in this?
Oh, I can see a lot of things that are me or were me, hopefully. Hopefully were me more. But I still, from a standpoint of, you know, Jamie and I know even recently, I've been feeling some shame about all the pain I've caused her. You know, as you understand more about what you've done, I think that comes. So still a work in progress, but yeah, I guess I don't necessarily feel a benefit to labeling myself at this point, but I do feel a benefit from reading your book and understanding more and thinking about the strategies that you're using to, you know, release those things and to work through them and to confront the insecurities. That's really what I loved about your book. I haven't got all the way through it, but everything I've read so far has been very interesting and useful for me, is that you're giving, yeah, what you've said already, really, but the whole idea of this person is very insecure inside, and instead of being afraid to get alongside them in the path, let's understand that and approach them and be there for them and see what happens.
So what is typically, you know, what does it look like when you're working with some of your clients over the years? Like, what can you share, any stories or similar patterns?
Yeah, sure. You know, my work, as you and I were chatting about earlier, Jamie, my work is really rewarding. It's hard, it's frustrating and challenging too, but there is great rewards in escorting someone through that really hard, dark, difficult path to looking at hurtful, painful realities of once upon a time, figuring out why they do what they do. Like, how did they construct these masks that they've been living behind for such a long time? What was the motivational driver? Beginning to be able to grieve and forgive themselves. That's the first step to what, you know, when Kevin, when you were talking about, you know, appreciating the pain of a partner's experience. I mean, that's the goal, right? To be able to get to that point where you're liberated from all this sense of badness, because that's another kind of self-focus, right? You know, I'm such a terrible, horrible person, you know, but you're able to move from that to what it was really like for the person that I hurt, that I offended. And you can feel that more freely because you have a better understanding of this side of you that was constructed. It's not to make an excuse for it. It's to understand it, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So a very rewarding part of my work is someone who can sustain the treatment process. It's a long one. And really move through to that place where they have a more fortified, healthy adult at the end.
Yeah. So a lot of a lot of my personal experience has been with people I think your book would call, or maybe you would call both, a covert narcissist. Can you talk about, I feel like a couple that I've spent a lot of time with, there's times where they do reach out and they're kind of testing the waters. Is there anything particular around covert narcissism, and any things you notice about how they reach out?
You know, most individuals over the along the spectrum of narcissism, whether it's the grandiose type that we all think of in terms of classic narcissism, you know, the look at me and the pounding the chest and the master of the universe. But on the other side of the spectrum with covert narcissism, which is different, doesn't mean it's quiet, but it's different in that there's a higher sensitivity to criticism, even higher. There is a higher degree of trauma usually in the background, need for a lot more reassurance and recognition and appreciation. There's a lot of the extraordinariness that comes with a covert narcissist is not based on, you know, look at my suit and let me tell you how many important people I know and how expensive my car is. It's more based in the extraordinary suffering. So it's a kind of victim identity. And that's difficult in therapy, because therapists who don't understand this identity, you know, this formed identity as a kind of extraordinary form of narcissism, can miss it and sort of get confused and sometimes tricked into thinking that they've already encountered the most vulnerable part of this person sitting there. And they haven't. There's still a lot deeper to go. So it's a lot of needing reassurance, a lot of hard times sort of letting go of being the martyr, being the one who carries, I have more pain than you. You know, I did this because. A lot of denial, a lot of devaluing, a lot of dismissal, a lot of justification. I mean, they both do that, you know, to a large degree. What brings them into therapy is not that different on either side. It's typically because, you know, someone has said, you got to get help or else.
Yeah. Yeah.
But occasionally they may wander in because, you know, the panic is overwhelming them. Anxiety is taken over, depression, they're not sleeping. And so there's a fear of sort of losing the edge, right?
Do you, so sometimes I've thought about, okay, so I wonder if I could refer to Wendy. Do you have an interesting thing though? Like if, do people, as a narcissist, I'm wondering about when they come to you, do they Google and say, oh, this person is an expert with narcissists, or how do you deal with that part of it?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to hide, you know, when you've got 30,000 pages with the word narcissism next to your name. And so they come in often very, well, they're coming in begrudgingly already. So, you know, I always say, oh, happy day. I've got a non-voluntary client coming in the door. And then they come in having done their homework, because they always do their homework.
Yeah, yeah.
And, oh, I guess I'm a narcissist. That's why I'm seeing you. And now their mission is to prove me wrong.
Yeah.
I haven't even said anything yet, but they're there to kind of prove that, in fact, they are not the person who has issues with narcissism. It's all the morons I work with. It's my partner. My family. It's, you know, the grocer down the street, the guy who pumps the gas. It's always someone else's fault. So, yeah, we start off on a challenging foot. And I'm, you know, you said something earlier, Kevin, about labels. And I like to dispense with labels really fast. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I find they're just pejorative and not that helpful. They're helpful among all of us for a little while, especially clinicians. We start to get a sense of what we're doing. They like to see it more as a broad sketch as opposed to a one-size-fits-all. So, you know, I move quickly from the word narcissism. When they so am I a narcissist? Do I meet the criteria? And I say, you know, if you really want to know if you meet the criteria, we can go through it point by point. But I'd rather that we start looking at how your story, how your life experiences that have become embedded in your memory have been affected throughout the years, what gets retrieved under what conditions and why you show up the way you do. Because narcissists will be the first ones to say, this is just who I am. And I say, it's not who you are. It's how you become under certain conditions. And that's the who is, you know, whether you like it or not, the who, we're, it's part of being human, and we're all human, and we all have to greater and lesser degrees, pretty similar needs. But how we become under very specific conditions might look very different. And that's what we need to kind of pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see what you did there. That's a very peaceful way to start with someone instead of, well, all right, we're going to start labeling you and see if you qualify.
Yeah, which just gets defenses really high and it becomes very combative. And, you know, they actually like that. I mean, a lot of the narcissistic men that I treat really like the combat and the contest and the who's going to win and I'm going to be right and I'm going to bring you all the science and evidence and research that I read. And did you read this too, Wendy? And so, you know, I like to really get it down quickly to kind of like, let's get down to the bare bones of how we all operate as humans in the world. We all have a story. We all have a once upon a time. And we all have a temperament and a biological structure. And together that makes a personality. Let's figure out how yours became you.
Yeah. Yep. Very good. Well, you talk a lot about schema therapy. So how do you, well, I need to know more about schema therapy. I'd like to understand more. And I hear, like, I learn from hearing someone talk about it even better than reading your book. Although your book is, it's very easy to read. It's very easy to understand. But what would you say to our audience and to me about how do you define it? What is a schema? You know, anything like that?
Well, I'm really biased about this one because, you know, I'm passionate about schema therapy and I've been, you know, fortunate enough to be part of the original think tank in the development of this model founded by my mentor and my dear friend, Dr. Jeffrey Young, who's in New York City. Uh-huh. And this model is based on, I mean, it's informed by some really important work. We think about attachment, you know, how we all come into the world and attach to the world and develop our sense of security or lack thereof. So it sort of follows the trend of some really science-informed understanding of human development. But here's the kind of the nutshell of it. Schema therapy is a needs-meeting model. So it's, schemas are basically traits, if you will, that if you think about a really hard, long-standing belief that was developed when you were very young, based on your early experiences and based on needs that were not adequately met. So we pay a lot of attention to things like, if you did not get your need for understanding, for comfort, for affection, you might, not necessarily, right? Because we know there's lots of little intervening variables, and you might have had a lovely coach or a grandma or a teacher or a therapist along the way who really reconciled these things early enough in your life. So it didn't become a schema, but we all have schemas. No one has a perfect beginning. And so let's say you didn't get those things. You might have what we call emotional deprivation schema. There are 18 of these early maladaptive schemas that have been analyzed and studied over the years and around the world. The model is very comprehensive. Comprehensive look at what we learn, what we experience, what needs didn't get met, how they form our beliefs about ourselves and the world, the intense emotional experience and body sensation that lives along the lines of these schemas when they're activated, because they were formed when we were very little, right? And so as little people, we're rather powerless and innocent and vulnerable, and we do our best to survive in difficult environments and difficult times. And this is where our coping gets designed. So schema therapy pays attention to unmet needs, these schemas or traits that get triggered throughout our life cycle under certain looks like, smells like, sounds like, tastes like, you know, suddenly the brain is in a time warp space and it's pulling information from the archives. And we're reacting, unfortunately, in many conditions from our survival system, like we did when we were little. And while it may have helped then, it doesn't necessarily help us in the here and now. So it's all about learning how to get those needs met, how to kind of reorganize the way things have been designed in our memory, you know, wallpapered around our memory, so that we can have new experiences. Here's a simple example. When I'm working with a narcissist who's working so hard to impress me every minute, performing, impressing the world, trying to win recognition. And I say something like, if you only knew that you were fine.
I know I'm fine. I'm better than fine.
No, if you really knew that you were fine, you wouldn't have to spend so much time trying to prove yourself or win approval, impress. What a burden you've had to carry your whole life. When you know you're fine, the only time you have to do that is like maybe a job interview. You don't have to do that in all of your interpersonal experiences. So it's how to shift that core sense. And it's, you know, it's completely automatic and not conscious, but how to shift that core sense of being unlovable and shameful to I'm fine. I'm good. I was always good. And there's all method, you know, for doing that, which is, you know, highly emotionally energized experience using the resource of the imagination.
Yeah. So these schemas, by the way, are not hard to understand. I'll give you the space to speak about them in any specifics that you want to. I will ask you on the one that's trying to impress you, which one is that? I won't venture
a guess.
That would
be approval seeking.
Okay. Yeah.
And again, a lot of people have the same schemas. So that doesn't mean if you have what I would sometimes show as a profile of narcissism, the typical schema profile, meaning which ones they tend to have within their makeup, which ones in their orbit. You may have the same. I may have some of the same ones. That doesn't mean we're narcissistic, because so much of it depends on how did you cope? How do you cope when that gets triggered?
Mm-hmm.
I have partners in couples therapy where they have very similar schemas. But when she, for example, let's say she's not a narcissist, when she gets triggered and she's feeling shame and humiliation, she beats herself up. She tries to make it all better and take care of everybody and people please. She goes into self-sacrifice. He gets defensive. angry, bullies, attacks, denies, blames. So same schema, right? Their defectiveness gets triggered. They feel bad, but they respond differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what becomes so important in the needs meeting. It's not just getting the need met and trying to heal the schema, but watching how that affects the trend in terms of their coping style. And some of those coping modes are really just based in, you know, temperament or modeling, or, you know, you watched your sibling do it one way, so you do it a different way.
So I'm curious, from a parent's perspective, you know, are there some things that you suggest that parents can do to support kids so we're not just turning out narcissists?
Excellent question. And a lot of parents are really, really super concerned about that these days. In my co-parenting the narcissist online community, this is a big question. I have another online community for people who are living, loving, leaving narcissists in their lives, and big question about their kids. You know, one of the greatest gifts we can still give our kids is discipline. It's not a dirty word. And that includes the ability to tolerate frustration, the ability to not have immediate gratification, the ability to be uncomfortable sometimes, the ability to take turns, and to know when kind of enough is enough, even though they may not like it. So it's a lot of distress tolerance, right? Helping our kids learn how to soothe themselves. You know, we provide enough of those hugs and that love and assurance and comfort, but also making sure that they're learning how to soothe themselves in ways that aren't just, you know, picking up the chocolate bar or, you know, immediately, you know, hiding and disappearing into their iPads or their phones, but really being more conscious. And it's hard. You know, technology has made that really, really difficult, and really good parents are having a hard time against this big wave that they face. But I think the greatest gift we can give them is model empathy, because that's a hard one. And kids don't come into empathic awareness right away. I mean, some do, but it's rare. They're supposed to be narcissistic as little ones, right? It's supposed to be all about them. That's the way it is. It's supposed to be about them. But, you know, little by little, with discipline, we teach them that other people share the planet, other people share, and it won't always be exactly as you like it to be, and that's okay. And that all feelings are feelings, you know? We don't have to be happy every minute of the day to be okay.
Yeah,
we don't have to be the best of the best, and we don't have to constantly be the most extraordinary and bringing home every trophy. That's not what makes you valuable. I mean, narcissists walk around with this equation of your work is your worth. You know, your performance and how high you achieve is your value.
So how often are you working with business owners? Just out of curiosity.
Well, business owners, you know, narcissists come in every size, shape, and color, right? So they're not all just at the upper echelons of work life, but many are. And you could see why, you know, given kind of how they come through life. And they do tend, many of them, just to be the chosen child because they are so bright and so gifted, and they show so much possibility that they get selected in the family to be the one who's going to, you know, lead the charge and elevate this family. Good intentions, just, you know, missing the mark on a lot of other important needs. So I work with a lot of lawyers and surgeons and business owners and CEOs of companies and
so
politicians and celebrities. Yeah.
So when, let's take some examples of if they come to you, after they come to you, you know, like my idea, perspective, thinking of the narcissist is, first of all, they're coming in, you know, like not believing that they're a narcissist or that they need to change. But then at some point along the journey, I would imagine that as they're shifting their thinking, some of the fears coming up would be if they do change, that everything's going to fall apart, or that Absolutely. They're not going to be able to be, you know, the hero that they were. Is that true?
It's the biggest fear. You just hit it right on the head, Jamie. The biggest fear is, and they use this expression very often, I'm going to lose my edge. You know, I mean, like, you can't be a big shot on Wall Street and be walking around with all your feelings hanging out. You know, so I get that. I get a lot of mockery and cynicism, but there's real fear driving that bus, right? So again, I have to come back to, so you really think it's your rigidity, your lack of emotion, your lack of humanness that makes you so good at what you do? I kind of think you've already aced that course. I kind of think you already have the skills and the talent. I kind of think you could have both. And here's the weird irony, Joe. I think that with emotion, you might find, you know, with emotion and more emotional satisfaction and connection and less burden in that department, you might actually find yourself upping your edge. It's hard for them to imagine, right? Because they were often taught that, you know, emotions are just for weak little people. And they're shameful.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, you're giving us a lot to really think about and just kind of connect the dots on. There's something else I want to dig into just a little bit, because this podcast is called Business Addicts. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason is because we do work with addiction in both our clients, as well as Kevin and I, you know, share our story of what it was like going through addiction. And so I would love to hear, you know, where you end up seeing addiction play in and kind of parallel or merge with narcissism.
Yeah. I mean, I can see it in many forms with narcissism, because one of the chief modes for coping is what we call the self-stimulating, self-soothing mode. Now, this is a maladaptive mode. This is not a healthy, I'm not talking about healthy adult coping. I'm talking about where the survival system kicks in and it's, I got to get a fix to disconnect from these emotions. Because typically it's when they're outside a place where they have an audience, you know, where they have people to impress, or where they have stimulating distractions, like in their work, or even just with an audience of one, when they're alone. And when the tendency for vulnerability to come up is great. So this is a disconnect, right? But their disconnect isn't like other people might disconnect and just, no, I'm not saying this is good, but, you know, someone else might sit down with a bag of potato chips and turn on the TV. This is someone who needs big stimulation. So it might be cocaine, gambling. More often than not, it's sex. And there's a couple reasons for that with narcissists. One is they're not real good on the intimacy front. So having sex through pornography, having sex with a sex worker, even having random sex with another person is the drug of choice in many cases, because you don't have to really show up. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to please. You don't have to take care of somebody else's needs. It's just all about you. And if it's porn, even, it's like, it's at your convenience. It's on demand. And it's a fix, it's a rush, and it can become addictive. And we know through the research that the brain will develop kind of an addictive, habitual, you know, seeking this out over time. It works, and they feel entitled to it. So here's the big thing. We call it hypersexual narcissism. There's this whole fantasy of grandiosity that can also get fed into their sexual experiences. You know, they'll superimpose themselves into images they're watching or experiences they're having if it's a sex worker. And they get to be whoever they want to be, you know, for that moment. So there's a lot of that grandiose fantasy that can be fulfilled for the time being. There is no need for remorse, right? Or at least it feels like there's no need for remorse, even though they're creating a major betrayal trauma for a partner on the other side. But mostly the differentiating factor in treatment is they feel entitled to it. They feel justified. They're quick to point the finger of blame, hard for them to be empathic to the other experience and to get into a state of remorse. There's just too much shame loaded in there underneath. And so it's not impossible. I mean, I've worked with plenty of individuals who I've seen through the course of restoring trust, and it's a beautiful thing that happens. It's a hard thing, really hard for partners, because I think, again, you have to do this inside-out thing where you first the narcissist has to go inside and figure out, how did this happen? How did this whole part of me become to be, right? They have to learn about addiction, right? And what happens in that cycle. But once they can, and they can be in a more therapeutic way off the hook, not just jumping off the hook through getting defensive and entitled, once they can do that, then there's space to be able to look inside the experience of a partner who made a discovery that was heartbreaking. and world-changing, then they can begin to do that. And that's when you see this beautiful gem that I call the beautiful gem, the golden nugget of empathy, begin to take place, right? Knowing the internal experience of another. And that's the work.
As you're talking and very clearly connecting to what I've experienced, and I also know for myself that as Kevin started to heal, I ended up, you know, realizing that I had resentment stored and, you know, lots of different emotions on my end. And then even, you know, coming through addiction and then realizing, like for Kevin, that he didn't necessarily have the emotional intelligence that I thought, you know, like he's super intelligent, but somehow there was like this disconnect. Just because the addiction stopped didn't mean that there was this EQ. I don't know if I can explain what
experience, but that is a good explanation. I think, you know, for so many, it's not about intelligence. It's about the emotional awareness, the emotional appreciation. And until that whole, you know, that whole internal world is, until there's a sensibility there and there's a reconnect with one's own vulnerability, you know, with the hypersexual narcissist in my work, with their vulnerability, till they can connect with their own vulnerability, it's rather difficult to connect with someone else's. I mean, they may show up as heroes at times, but again, the heroics are often for their own benefit, even though it may be benefiting someone else, by the way. But it's a big, as you know, Jing, it's a really powerful, painful piece of work, because betrayal trauma is a real thing. And it's a really, really hard thing to recuperate from. Because I work with partners too on the other side of this, and then eventually couples.
Yeah, I can definitely identify with a lot of what you're saying that applies to all humans, whether or not I was a narcissist, which I know I was at some level, you know, somewhere on the spectrum. There's just so much of the book that I can see that does align with what I've put myself through, let's say, and others. But I was thinking about what you're saying, and if I'm triggered by something that's hard for me to deal with, then I'm consumed completely with what I'm dealing with, and not at the same time. I'm glad for now, where I can at least know there's something I'm not being there for her in. I can see that. But like, not always can I be available for both of us. You know, that's still something I'm working on.
No, it's hard because, again, as humans, our schemas don't go away. They're part of memory. And memory, unless we have injury to the brain, God forbid, you know, our memories are there. And so we are susceptible to having triggers or reactivations of experiences. The real goal for success is not in, like, eliminating our schemas completely. We can't, but it's in getting better and better at lowering the frequency of triggering, right? And that comes with strengthening the healthy adult inside and really caring for that vulnerable part underneath. So less frequency, lower intensity, quicker recovery. I mean, that's what we look for. Like, is it happening less often that I'm getting triggered? Is it less intense for me? And how fast am I recuperating? Am I able to sort of bring my wise mind on board to say, oh, that's a schema trigger, right? I was completely, like, distracted for a moment, like lost in my own stuff.
Yeah.
I've really noticed Kevin improve in that, especially in the last 2 years. And it's one of those things where sometimes I feel like I've said, you know, like, he has really improved and there's more. Like, can both be true?
Sure.
I like what Tony Robbins says about this, of like, for men, it's easy the way he explains it is like, okay, so you can be all up in your head, right, about everything, or you could choose to be in your heart, or at least both, you know, like, if you can't go completely to your heart and what you really feel, then let's weigh both. Let's be aware of both. At least that helps me, because then, I mean, cause I can logically get in several rabbit holes, right? Of like, well, this is a problem because of this. But if I go to, is that heavy or is that light? Oh, do I have some guilt in this area? Is there something here for me to work on?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, I do. You know, is there also something I can actually feel for Jamie too because of just doing all this work? But sometimes, not always. But, you know, is there something maybe for her? Yes, but I got to deal with my stuff first. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's part of the kind of the homework in schema therapy too, very similar to what you were just outlining, Kevin, which is this a trigger? Could this be a trigger? And I'm forgetting that I actually have the power to move my attention someplace else. I don't have to stay fixed on this. Let's see, where do I want to go?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll look for what else is happening in my body. There may be other messages there, right? So we forget that we can actually point our attention to other places that may have even more relevant data for us.
I'm curious, Wendy and Kevin, I know you and I both, both Kevin and I love data, but from different perspectives. Which we can bring both to the podcast. So I apologize, Kevin, if you want to wrap back around to something else. But
yeah, maybe go back to something. I don't want to wrap up.
That's what I mean. You might want to wrap back around to something. But I'm curious, Wendy, when you think about the future and the part that you feel called to play in that, you know, what are some of the things that you would love to see be true in the field that you're working in or even in your part in it in the next couple of years?
I think we're moving in that direction. So it's rather exciting. And I hope that we will continue to learn more and more and more about, you know, the body and the brain connection. You know, it's become more important for us to pay attention to the fact that, you know, memory experience isn't just here. It's not like just in here, but it's here. It runs through the nervous system. And there's so many other places where we can get really important information to connect with ourselves and to heal ourselves. We have memory in our muscles. You know, we have memory that comes through, flowing through our bloodstream and through our nerves and in our nervous system. And so I love, you know, I love the work of Dan Siegel, who was also one of my mentors. And he's the, you know, the father of interpersonal neurobiology, if you're not familiar. But he talks a lot about, you know, this capacity to move our awareness, to pay attention. And a lot of the more recent, I'll say, neuroscientists who are now integrating with psychotherapy and psychology and looking at how important it is to do this thing that's called bottom-up processing, like slow down. I'd like to see more slowing down, paying attention to what the body is trying to tell us. We have language, yes, we have memory stored, but it's not just here. And we can get really stuck in just talking through things as opposed to really experiencing and re-experiencing something in a new way. This is the beauty of schema therapy in the future for me is just helping therapists continue to appreciate the power of what we call re-scripting our lives through our imagination. You know, because the imagination is an unbelievable resource for feeling something in a whole new way. And if you doubt that, just think about your dreams, the most vivid ones.
Yeah, I like what someone said. I can't quote who it was, but that, like, you know, we have 10% of our mind that's consciously consuming about 11 bits of information, maybe a little less in some of our cases. And then we have the subconscious mind that's handling about maybe 4 billion, something like that. And then we've got our spirit, intuition, all the rest of it that's available to the imagination side, to the future, to what's possible. So I like that balance of, for me, a lot of things, I can get pretty consumed about the past and what I need to heal from and all that. But it's been, you know, I got to be aware, there's an opportunity to be more aware of, okay, so like you just said, we can reimagine what the future is. We can take along, this is kind of what I heard you say too, as we heal, as we work through this, get new tactics, we have the chance to use what we learned in the past and what we can imagine that we want to be in the future.
And we can reimagine the past too. See, that's the beauty of imagery and re-scripting, is that when we can really imagine someone standing up for us when there was no one there. To really imagine, like, here you are stranded. If this was your experience as a child, for example, where you're stranded and you don't have an advocate, and it's scary. And now you imagine what it would be like to have that advocate, to have someone stand up. Or you imagine your parent who may have been neglectful or hurtful, suddenly drinking a magic potion and being this parent that you really needed and you deserve to have. And what would that feel like? And you just continue to soak up the energy of what would that be like? Now, it's never going to mean that you wipe out what really happened, but what you're starting to wipe out is the truth you've carried about that original experience. So for example, a parent who says, you're a loser, you're a loser, you're a loser, you're a failure. And you remember the face of the parent, you remember the angst and the scowl. And now we reimagine maybe someone saying, hey, knock it off. This is a precious kid. What's with you? What's your problem? You need some help. Or we imagine the father suddenly melting into being this lovely father. Well, the past will still be the past. And as my clients say, you can't change the past, Wendy. And I say, well, no, we can't change the past, but we can change the way it's been organized in your memory. So you'll always remember that that was kind of sad and really sad for that little guy. But you won't be carrying the message of I'm a loser. Because it's going to become really clear to you that dad was wrong. That was not the truth. So the whole reimagining, making sense out of things. And I'm a bit of what people know as the empathy junkie, because I kind of believe empathy can cure all things. And just really think that with empathy, we are constantly making sense out of things. We're understanding as clearly as possible, resonating with something that's real and that matters, or resonating with the experiences of another.
Do you think that it's important for people that have maybe experienced trauma of some sort, and maybe whatever capacity that is, to share their stories, or for people to talk about this, even within communities where normally it's like, let's just keep that kind of hush hush. Like, what's better in this space?
Well, I think it's always better to have, again, to have empathy, to have someone really get it, to resonate with you, to offer compassion, because that's different than empathy, right? To offer compassion is so healing. To tell a story and to be held in a way with like honor, and for someone to see your courage and your survivorship, for someone to just hold you in that painful place that you may be living in that moment. It's not for everyone. I mean, there are certainly people who need professional assistance in being able to reconcile some of those issues because they still hold themselves highly accountable, or it's just way too unbearable. It's way too dangerous. Their fragile nervous system can't tolerate the re-experiencing of the story. So it takes a little time to sort of develop that muscle. But for many, sharing a story in a community with others who have also suffered can be just, I think, one of the greatest paths to healing.
Yeah. For me, it was working with a coach first, you know, like it wasn't a big community. And then, but I will say that this podcast has been a huge part of going deeper. Like when you start to be willing to share the, where you are and where you're going and more along the journey, then you go deeper and you're like, oh, there's a lot more possible when I'm starting to use what I learned to reach out to others and connect with others and be vulnerable.
Absolutely. You know, that's really a gift.
I'd like to ask you about empathy. So we often hear, you know, empathy versus sympathy. What is your definition of empathy? How do you notice it in others?
Empathy is, I think I'm going to say something first and then come right back to your question. I think when it comes to issues of narcissism, I get a lot of flack from people sometimes who say, why do I have to waste my time being empathic to a narcissist? And I understand that they're not understanding what I mean by empathy. Or even if they are, they feel it shouldn't be their tedious responsibility to have to do this. And my answer is, you don't have to. But I do think it's a great way to liberate yourself from self-blame when you really understand what it is you know, it's a wonderful emancipation tool, if you will, for your, it frees you. Empathy itself means being able to understand the experience of another. And here's a simple way to think about that. You're watching a movie, and the casting director, the directors, the writer of the story, they've done this brilliant job of really developing the character well. Let's say the lead character, who starts out in the story as this, you know, innocent little child who's growing up in some environment, you know, and you sort of see the hardships of the child and the suffering of the child. You're sympathetic, basically. You're feeling compassion. You want to jump in and save the child. So that's more than empathy. It becomes more, you become more empathic to this as the child grows and you see the child getting involved with the wrong gang of kids. Well, that just makes sense, doesn't it? Given like what the models were like in his life. Yeah. And now you see the child, you know, kind of manipulating partners as he's becoming a young adult. And oh, we don't like it. We don't like it. We're not liking him anymore. But it makes sense to us how he arrived there. And it makes sense to us. It's resonating for me. Like I can feel this inside of me. That's empathy. We don't have to agree with it. We don't have to endorse it. Sometimes we do. We agree. We endorse it. But we don't have to. Empathy just means I get it. I understand it. I see it. I know you. I feel you inside of me. I can step in your skin because I've got your story inside of me. And I think for therapy, to the effect of a therapist really has to be able to carry that narrative inside of them in a skin felt way, not just an intellectual understanding of you with a lot of therapy jargon, but in a really skin felt way.
Well, that is some, I just love your energy. I could see how easy it would be to talk about things with you and get to the deep stuff. So it's pretty
deep
cool
stuff. It's good stuff.
Yeah. So, well, I just want to talk about your book just a little bit. I don't know how many books you've got, but this one, Disarming the Narcissist, is the one that I'm reading. You. Well, you sent it to me, so thank you for doing that.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoy.
Yes, I am. And just do a shout out for that. If you do have a narcissist in your life, this will help you understand what Wendy has shared with us today is a beautiful explanation of what she writes, but it also like talks more about the details. And then I think you have your contact info in this book, probably, right? Somewhere.
Yeah, there's some. I mean, I have lots of goodies on my website too.
Yeah.
So go to disarmingthenarcissist.com or just type my name in your browser. There's a lot of good stuff on my website. I've written some professional stuff too for clinicians who may be listening in. But yeah, thank you so much for all that you've said. I really appreciate that. It's very, very meaningful to me.
Very good. Yeah, we appreciate your time very much. And we will put some links to you as well in the show notes. So they'll be able to go to that.
Thanks for having me on your podcast. It's really lovely to know both of you. It's quite a gift to the community.
Very good. Yeah, we will be in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. And to stay in touch, email us at info@businessaddictspodcast.com.